It says we're broadcasting, so greetings to you, the listener slash viewer. This is the Casterbris podcast with a K. We used to call these vidcasts, didn't we, until the world of video casting and podcasting sort of collided into a homogenous podcast. So I'm here, Christian Corley, former editor of Casterbris.com, and joint co-host of the podcast with a K with Brian Terranova.
It's me, hello.
And James McLean, who this week is in his guise as Plasticine Man About Art Room Morph.
Don't call William Russell that. He's not Plasticine. He's just getting on a bit.
Indeed, yeah. So we're here once again to, we're back! Woohoo! And we're going to be talking about the Girl Who Died, the fifth episode of Doctor Who Series 9. Now, while I am sorting out a couple of things here with links, sharing links on the interweb nets so that people can find us, you might, we have no viewers at the moment, guys, you'd be fascinated to learn. If you're listening to this, don't think you're missing any particular visual treat if you're picking this up on Audio Boom or iTunes later in the week. It's just the three of us with our heads and probably just Doctor Who memorabilia, toys, books, that kind of thing behind us. Can you see that there? The Virgin New Adventures just there. There's some BBC books just there. And there's other stuff out the shot that you can't see. Obviously, James, if you want to say a few words, there you go. You get what do you get if you look at James?
The answer. Not the one I was expecting.
Yeah, that's what you get. Random books which are just about in my arm reach. There's no point in talking. I mean, there's no one listening at the moment, so a little bit of dead air won't harm anyone.
No, it would be, it rarely does on national broadcasting, not that I'd know anything about that. Of course, because I've only been on local radio. There is one thing we need to talk about before we proceed, and that is podcast live on YouTube, not Hive live. That is our new website.
Oh,
and
yes,
I need to tell the readers about the podcast.co.uk, which I'm just loading up now and pinching the URL. Now, I'm not sure. Can we do something kind of like fancy with? Do we have like a whiteboard or anything on Google Hangouts? Does it do things like that?
Yeah, it would be nice, wouldn't it?
And then I can just like put up. That's not really working. Hello, viewers. Greetings there. We're just discussing our new website at thepodcast.co.uk. It's probably not too much to just use this draw thing here. Will that work? I'm just going to try a draw here and then text.
Well, what are you trying to do?
I'm just trying to write thepodcast.co.uk. There you go. There you go. So you can find us there, basically.
Well, I mean, why not use a proper whiteboard?
Have you got an actual proper whiteboard, James?
Yes.
Okay.
And it's very hard to... I think you're probably better actually just not...
I love your handwriting. The woman who... the girl who died. Episode 5 of Doctor Who Series 9. In which the Doctor and Clara find themselves separated from the TARDIS, kidnapped by Vikings, and then facing off against the Maia, a powerful galactic warrior race. There's a lot of things to talk about with this episode, and one of the things that struck me was how nice it felt to have what was essentially a single-part story. It was almost refreshing.
Can't win, can they?
I that was one thing I actually did like about the story. It kind of, I know I always bring this show up a lot, but it kind of was reminiscent of something. I think The X-Files is the best example, where like part one of a story was its own contained, and part two is still a continuation in a way, but it's also its contained. And I did like that. I think what I liked most was it seemed like the story had a good pace. And I was really hoping it wasn't going to have that to be continued at the end to continue the current main story. And then when I saw all that got wrapped up, and then it was more a continuation for the character, and I've forgotten her name.
Ashilda.
But yeah, Ashilda, that's it, thank you. Then it was much nicer. It was much nicer. It was, I don't know. You'd think having two-parters fill up an entire season would be nice, but for some reason it was nice to actually just sit there and basically watch an entire wrapped-up story, for the most part an entire wrapped-up story, all in one go.
Yeah, that was refreshing. James, how do you feel about that particular aspect of the episode?
Yeah, I think it was good. I mean, as I've said before, I tend to, until I see a particularly really strong two-parter, which I've never really felt massively keen on, I first angular story. That time, I think, as Brian said, I think it's a nice balance between the two, where you have a single self-contained story that does carry on without feeling that you are left hanging, or the fear that your story is now two parts, which means you have one less story the series. Because, I mean, let's face it, we've had, what, 5 episodes now, and we've had 3 stories. So you start to lose the amount of different adventures you have in a show, so it's a kind of good balance to do it this way.
I'm not too concerned with, like, you know, losing stories. I don't feel like we have to sort of like race through stories. I just want good stories. I don't care how many of them.
But that's the point. If you don't have good two-parters, you've lost another episode where you might have had a good one-parter. You've just expanded a story which didn't need to be expanded. I mean, I'd still say the first one with the Daleks took away for me a possible other story in this season by the first part, which was to me was very meandering. And unnecessary. So that's how I mean. I don't mean necessarily that they've got to have as many stories as possible. It's just that I think if you kind of feel that you take extra long to tell something that isn't very good or doesn't feel worth its length, you've lost the opportunity to tell something else because you've only got a limited...
Right. We're having a little bit of trouble with the who appears when we're talking. So I'm having to do this manually for some reason. If you get sick of the sight of one of the Castorbis commenters put it a few weeks ago, a sort of a courtroom illustration of Matt Smith with a couple of Cybermen, or if you get sick of looking at me, then what I'll do is I'll just do this, and then Brian can move his lips a bit, and we'll pretend it's Brian talking. Oh, you can do it like that, yeah.
Yeah.
Excellent.
Yeah, I've no idea what even happened there. That was not fun. All I saw was my face for far too long.
Yeah, I know. I feel the same way about my own thing here. So, yeah, we are, can you see that there? That means it doesn't actually mean we're recording live. It just means that my microphone's on. But, yeah, we are live, and we've got 4 viewers now. We will do our utmost to make sure that we respond to any comments that you have for us, dear viewers. Hello, here's Jeff Waddell. Was totally uninterested in last night's episode. It felt flat. And this Maisie Williams, I don't watch Game of Thrones, that everyone was on about was as wooden as one of their longboats. Electric eels, dash what? Now, it's interesting. I'm not going to dwell on Maisie or Game of Thrones at this point, but I did see something about electric eels that was mentioned on Twitter, on the Radio Times, which I think I retweeted on the podcast page on Twitter. And if I just bring that up, there's really... Because it didn't really... I'm not a big eel person. I don't know an awful lot about eels. I think most people don't know that much about eels, so won't be aware that electric eels are usually found in warmer climes than, you know, the North Sea or the North Atlantic. On first glance, it would seem a bit of artistic license has been used there. However, it's not completely beyond the realms of possibility that the Vikings could have, you know, farmed some electric eels in journeys into the South Atlantic. So we shouldn't, like, totally rule it out. I mean, it's certainly a surprise if you think about it in the, like, historical context that they mainly stayed in the North. But, you know, we know that they went to North America. It isn't completely unlikely that they would have gone south as well. So, what do you guys think of that?
I really had no basis for eels whatsoever to really make an opinion one way or the other, but I did find it just kind of odd that, you know, this fishing village just had a bunch in a bucket. It was, it didn't seem like the kind of thing that people fishing in a village would have found, you know. I pictured, I don't know, flounder, trout.
I think they kind of just introduced them as being there, didn't they, using the baby talk, the baby translation. And I can appreciate both points of view, but I also think it's very dangerous. Now, this isn't just Doctor Who, this is just life in general. It's very dangerous to assume that, but particularly when we talk about history, it's very dangerous to assume that particular peoples were primitive. Because as the study of language shows over the past sort of 1,200 years or so, language is barely developed in the terms of how we address people and how we converse. Obviously, the words have changed, but the formats of language have barely changed. So, given how much we've advanced technologically in that same period, particularly the last 250 years, it is kind of a dangerous game to play. It's just assuming that people in the Middle Ages or before that were primitive, because they weren't primitive. They just didn't have the same tools that we have. They still had the imaginations, etc. So, dangerous game, but I can appreciate anyone being confused by the eel thing, because, as I say, I didn't even realise it was an issue until I put it on the BBC. On the Radio Times website. I just want to do a little sidestep from this episode, and then we'll come back to it. Because obviously, and you know, I don't want to dwell on these things too much, and things are going to keep on happening probably until the whole leaving Casterbus thing. That is what's mostly behind that kind of plays out. But I was I did notice that Eddie from Outpost Scarrow has thrown in his towel, as it were, for his involvement with Outpost Scarrow, which he set up years ago, for exactly the same reasons. So that's a bit sad, and it does seem that this is having an effect, not Eddie, not us, but like this general thing is a lot of people are getting quite annoyed about it. So how that will play out, I don't know. But it is... I don't feel vindicated or anything like that, because, you know, I'd had it up to here with various bullshits, but it's good to know that I wasn't being oversensitive or anything like that. It is an annoying bit of nonsense. So, guys, we were talking about the podcast.co.uk before, and then we kind of got sidetracked with James's ability with a whiteboard. What I wanted to say specifically was that Colin Grigson says, welcome to Google Hangouts. Thanks, Colin. Thanks a lot. We have the podcast.co.uk, and we currently have series 2 and series 3 of the podcast, and series 1 as well. So that's the 2007 to 2008 podcasts, then everything from 2011 and 2012. I've still got to update to 2013, 2014. So we're getting up to date. It should happen in the next few days. So in the future, our podcast will be going live. It's basically, you remember the old podcast section on Casterbus? It's basically the podcast section with its own website. So every time there's a new podcast, it'll be on there, and you'll be able to see it in comments if you like to on there. So it's simple as that. So the girl who died, Maisie Williams from Game of Thrones, the eponymous girl. Casting was interesting. You know, this was the episode that Brian Blessed was cast in.
Oh, really? No, I didn't know. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. But...
he was Odin originally. So obviously we saw, I think it was David Schofield playing the part in the end. Bit of a shame that we didn't get Brian Blessed, but obviously he fell ill, so that is a shame. Casting-wise, it's kind of... I think there was a guy who's a comedian in there, and the tall guy playing... who's a lofty, the Doctor christened him, I believe. But before we get that, Sonic glasses, broken. Good or bad?
Good, so long as they don't come back again. Yeah, but they still worked. You know, you can break Sonic glasses and they'll still work. Go figure.
Well, if I brought my glasses in half, which is unlikely because obviously they're meta, I'd still be able to see out one side, so.
But would you be able to Sonic a helmet and make it work as a dream kind of 3D imager for, I don't know, a Droya, whatever her name is, Maisie. What's it?
A shielder.
The whole time watching it, I thought they kept calling her a shielder. And I'm like, okay, that's her job. She's a shielder. What does that do? And then I'm like, oh no, it's a shielder. You know, couldn't grasp that for the longest time. You know, finally got it, like, by the end of the episode. But, like, I can't retain it now, you know?
Yeah, okay. Listen, James, because neither of you guys watched Game of Thrones, so what? How? And just following up on our comments there, what did you think of Maisie Williams?
Yeah, she was fine. She didn't blow me away in any sort of way, I must admit.
Well, we've had rumours, but carry on.
Not to do with me, let's just clear that. To do with her, let's clear that line as well. I don't know. She was all right. She seemed quite pleasant. She seemed quite charismatic as an actress, but I didn't feel, for the amount of promotion on her, that she brought anything magical to the episode, if you see what I mean.
Yeah. Well, I think it's the Game of Thrones thing, is it? It's the same with the Spooks movie, isn't it, with Kit Harington?
I would say yeah.
Yeah, because obviously he was in the Spooks movie. He plays, he's dead now, Jon Snow. And he was killed in the last episode of Game of Thrones Series 4. And he was like the star of the Spooks movie. So they obviously tap into like the big thing that the actor's in. And they've done the same with Maisie Williams. It's probably saved them a lot of... PR effort and money, I should imagine. But while we're on the topic of PR and the girl who died, because I think I might have just said the girl who waited, the girl who died, overnight viewing figures. Doctor Who News report 4.85 million viewers watched Doctor Who, the girl who died, making Doctor Who the second highest rated show of the day. But again, Strictly Come Dancing had 9.66 million viewers, which is around 50% more. But Doctor Who has grown on the previous week, and I think that's a pattern that's continued, even with the two-parters. I think each episode has had a slightly higher audience.
Episode 2 had a lower, didn't it? It went down 3.5.
Yeah, it went up again with the last two, and it's gone up with this third one. So it's a very strange story with the ratings this season, isn't it?
Well, not really. I mean, you still got to say that you're sitting in a margin. If you take sort of 4.1 as your average, it's mediating around the same area. I don't think you're going to see it suddenly shoot up to 6 or 7 million as it's meant to be at. It's still ranging around roughly the same sort of viewing figures, give or take factors. I mean, I don't doubt that there were factors that brought one episode down to 3.5 and another one up to 4.8 and one down to 4. Do you know what I mean? It's still that same sort of audience range. So... I mean, like last week, there was people sort of crowing that it was rated over 4 million, and it was all, everything was okay. And you're thinking, well, no, it's still massively under everything else. It's massively under Strictly, which comes before it. You're seeing a massive drop-off at primetime slot. And again, as we said before, scheduling, I'm sure, is a major part of this.
Yeah, well, again, now this is another thing, which is why I was going on to the audience thing, is because this episode is the first one in this series that I would be happy to show to my little boy. Whereas the others, I said, ooh, no, don't think so, because there's a lot of stuff going on that's a little bit, not just over his head, but just feels kind of inappropriate, a bit too adult, or certainly aimed at older kids. But this time round, I didn't see any of that. It felt like more of a sort of old-fashioned Doctor Who story. I'm going to say old-fashioned. I just mean it wasn't dwelling on adult things or anything like that. It just got on, told the adventure. There was no, like, ideas about ghosts or anything like that. It was just the Doctor, Clara, landing somewhere, aliens involved. I know it was historical. But you know what I'm saying? It was just basically, it was an all-encompassing, single, straightforward adventure with no...
Well, it's one of the first...
Not too much messing about.
The last two episodes have been the first for a long time where it's just been a sort of, I suppose, what some fans would call a classic setup, where you do literally a companion in their TARDIS, landing, adventure occurs. And maybe what you can say is that this shows a very strong argument why this formula works so well, because you just get straight into it and it allows the story to just develop on its own without too much confusion or complexities. It can just be an adventure series. And maybe it needs to learn a little from its cousins in that sort of sense. You know, a lot of other shows in this similar format, the BBC, do that. And
you see, for me, I felt it had potential to be more of like a classic type Doctor Who story, but I felt they went too heavy on the comedy with all of the Vikings in the town being so comedic, being so idiotic, being so inept, rather than playing them a little bit more straight as a village of people who were farmers or blacksmiths who weren't fighters, and watching the Doctor and Clara have to train them. Instead, they took like a comedic approach, which it started off so well. I liked the beginning. I didn't mind the comedy in the beginning with Clara in space and the Doctor doing their thing. I actually like when TV shows show us a bit of an adventure in the beginning of another adventure. Like, we get to see that they're not always just doing the ones that we watch, you know? So I liked that, and I liked how they got taken away from the TARDIS so quickly. But when they got to the village, the things that really just kept sticking with me as annoying was how comedic it went, too comedic for me, and the baby talk. I'm getting a little tired of the Doctor being able to speak with animals and babies and so on. It's just like there's nothing he can't do. And he even says in this episode, there's nothing he can't do. He can do anything. And it's just kind of like, okay. And that's another part of it, too. Like, they do the whole reveal of why his face looks so familiar, and it's like, wow, okay, that's something we all already figured out. So it wasn't really a massive reveal.
Yeah, I was going to come to that as well, because that was, I mean, that's another one of those great Stephen Moffat ideas that are like hashtag totally obvious, dude.
Yes, absolutely. And that's just how this episode felt. It had great potential. I liked the aliens. I liked the concept. I liked the fact that I liked the type of setting that they chose. I loved how it started. I loved how they got there, just like James had said, and you had said, it felt like it was going in this classic direction. And then it just fell into that same old trap. Like, you know, Moffat just wants to write, Moffat's name is attached to it, so maybe I'm blaming him. Yeah. So the two of them there together, I don't remember who the other writer was, but I know Moffat's history as a writer is comedic. So it just seems like there's this trap, but like, I can go really funny with this, or I can try and play it a little bit more straight with some comedic moments. I'll go really funny instead, you know?
That's the problem I had with this, is that and again, it's all very subjective when we get to this point. But firstly, I didn't think it was a very sharp episode in the humor, and I'm not knocking Moffat or any of the writers on that, because they can write some very sharp and great moments and great Doctor dialogue.
Well, this was Jamie Matheson, who also wrote Flatline and Mummy on the Orient Express.
Absolutely, and there was Moffat, obviously, name-tagged in there as well, so assuming he had some input. But it didn't feel funny in any way that they usually feel, and I kind of feel one of the problems which I'm having with Capaldi's Doctor is that they keep trying to... They write him in a sense as if there's still a lot of Matt Smith in him, and he doesn't really play to that sort of strength. In the same way that Matt Smith didn't really play to the sort of dramatic gravitas that Tennant used to do. So it doesn't feel like they're really writing, particularly for Capaldi, enough. So he's coming out all the way through this episode, he's coming out with these rather dull, blunt, little sort of side references and off-topic jokes in that sort of way that's perpetuated since Tom Baker. And it doesn't really fit his Doctor. I don't feel that is what he's about. And he works best when he's sort of allowed to be a little more serious, a little more like in Listen, where you can have those tiny pockets when you have that moment. You think that's special. But when he's delivering it the whole time, it just doesn't feel like him. It feels written. It feels scripted. It feels unnatural, for me anyway. And it takes it out of the moment. It almost, again, feels an underconfidence in the ability to let this actor be the Doctor that he is, rather than keep writing these Matt Smithisms, which is essentially what I call this later day thing. I think they did the same a bit with Christopher Eccleston as well, but in fairness, they were fairly new to the show coming back. But his strengths were when he was a little less comedic and allowed to be serious or strong, and then you get very occasional pockets of humour which would work for him. But when they would try and play him on long planes of silliness, it just didn't feel quite right.
I mean, you can already predict what Stephen Moffat would say. If you, like, if a journalist put this to Stephen Moffat, he said, "Oh well, because it's so scary and it's on at that time slot, then you have to have funny moments to counterbalance I have to have the humour to combine the scary stuff to make the scary stuff scary. But I think it's toning, it's pitching the humour right, isn't it? That's the key.
Yeah, exactly.
And for, in this episode, for a comedy writer, a guy who got into the business as a comedy writer, to not be pitching the humour right.
But that's it, because you had, as Brian said, you had the humour already in there, whether you liked it or not, within the setup of the Vikings. Yeah. So you didn't need his constant blurb. The humour was already there. You had the space to allow him to play it a little more seriously.
You know, for me, we talked about this before. I'm not a big fan of the Thor movies, but what I will say they got right was the jovial nature of the Viking kind of aspect that they put on the Asgardians, you know? And it's great. It works well. They're funny. They're interesting. They're entertaining. And the humour is just built into them by the nature of who they are. Here, it was kind of like he did exactly what he was doing with the Scooby Gang, Vastra, Strax, and Jenny. You know, just using them for the comedic response to the episode. Yeah. Like almost as if, hey, this episode's not working. Why don't we make characters funny rather than interesting? You know, which I want to take back, too, back to Maisie Williams, because while you guys were saying that, you know, she may not have been, like, this massive, impressive person, I actually really liked how normal she played it, because you know what, this episode needed that. This episode needed some more straightforward characters, and I thought she was great. Yeah. I think in part two, when we see that she's basically the female Jack Harkness now, things are going to be much different for her character, and we'll see more over-the-top stuff from her, but as it is, I really liked her in this story, and I think that this is what this episode needed, some more realism. Especially when you think about it, you've got a regular old Earth village that's being invaded by these aliens that are calling themselves Odin. You'd think you would want to go for more realism. You already have the absurd there, and you would want some more realism added into that. And that's I guess where it just fell flat for me is it seems the tone for a lot of these stories just get lost and mixed up, and they don't understand the correct tone for how they should be. For me,
And again, what I was going to say is like the whole time slot thing. It felt like a 7 o'clock or even a 6:30, not an 8:20.
Yeah.
Some good comments here. Jeff Waddell, who might be Waddle, and if I'm mispronouncing that, then I do apologise. Capaldi chose the face of the bloke from Fires of Pompeii to remind him he can save people. Colin Baker must have chosen the face of Maxil to remind him he can be stroppy and useless.
Oh,
there's the belt, and there's the comment right down there. And Banana Wah says, Doctor Who's still not going down well with the casual viewer. My friend's view, another boring episode full of geeky in-jokes and references that no normal person would get. I know I say it a lot, but bring back Catherine Tate and David Tennant.
Well, I have to say,
I've noticed that.
I have to say that one of my cousins I was speaking to last night, and he's followed it, and he said he stopped watching after I think the first or second episode, which I think he means he's missed out stuff. But he was feeling the same; he just didn't feel it represented. He said it was just messy and silly. Now, again, not saying he represents a casual viewer, but he's someone else who's just dropped out of the mix.
Yeah, I've been speaking with a lot of friends lately, and we all seem to have the same feeling. Like, it's Saturday, it's Doctor Who Day. I guess I'll go out and do anything and, you know, just catch that later on DVR or something like that. You know, like, none of us are glued to our screen when this is on now the way we used to be, like, back in 2005 and upwards. It's just, it's on. Oh, it's Doctor Who, it's going to be on, you know, whatever, no problem. And it's just, I'm not feeling that urge, that draw to the show like I used to have. To me, it's the tone.
Is it definitely the tone? It's not like, I mean, we've had 10 years. It's not just like a gradual atrophy of that excitement.
You know, there were other shows that I have followed that have lasted. For instance, Stargate, The X-Files, and Star Trek, who've all lasted about like 7 to 10 years, depending on the particular show. And I was always there with them. You know, I was just always stuck. They were great. And I, you know, admittedly, maybe X-Files season 9, I started to drop off a bit, and Stargate maybe in season 10. So maybe it is just a natural. For instance, when Doctor Who first came back in 2005, people were saying, man, I hope it lasts another 26 years. And I remember my first thought was, never going to happen. Not in today's world. It just doesn't happen anymore. You're not going to get that. TV shows are lucky if they last 7. And if they go to 10, it's usually a mixed bag of, oh, that was good. Oh, no, they should have stopped the show 2 years ago kind of thing. Maybe the show needs a break, or maybe the show needs more changes. Maybe somebody shouldn't be in charge of the show for 5 years anymore. Maybe you should get 2 years out of somebody or 3 years out of somebody and then move on. I'm not talking the doctor, I'm talking the showrunner, but obviously the doctor, the companions, and so on, they all change. They're part of the effects that keep this show so vibrant.
That's interesting, isn't it? Why does the showrunner get a different sort of tenure to the lead face? If the lead face needs to move on, not just for themselves but for the show, surely there should be a similar sort of model for the production as well, to keep the production fresh. Because you change actor in a way, yeah, because it keeps it fresh too.
Yeah, I mean, and you look back at the past, you see somebody like Tom Baker. He, you know, for somebody who probably was just born to play the Doctor rather than anything else, and not to knock his talent because he's a great guy and fun actor, but he was so versatile with the Doctor and the show writers that came in for him. He was able to adapt and become what that show was becoming. So if you get actors who are like that, that can adapt and grow with the showrunners, that's fine. But you also need the opposite. The showrunners need to adapt and change as well to fit the people. And like you said, Moffat is writing Matt Smith. You know, and it must be very difficult for Capaldi to try and find his own Doctor when they're not writing for him. As Pertwee said, or as Tom Baker said, rather, writing for Pertwee. You know, he would suffer from that in the beginning. You know, and it's they just need to break out of a mold. Move on. Try something different.
There was the other problem.
I'm not convinced it's 10 years, you know, that, you know, the 10-year thing. I mean, you know, it could be, but there are other shows that are long-running, and they go through pits and troughs and what have you. I'm not convinced that the length of Doctor Who is why people are dropping away. Because if they were, then they would have been doing it in... Why wouldn't they have been doing it last year?
Well, to be honest, I know a lot of people...
Why wouldn't they have been doing it at Christmas?
Yeah, I mean, I've seen a lot of people dropping off kind of like mid-Matt Smith era, in my opinion. I know the numbers don't show it, but a lot of people over here that I know, we've all been feeling a little jaded by the whole show. And, you know, it's been going downhill steadily. It has its steps back up. Like, the 50th was enjoyable. About half of season 8 was enjoyable, you know. And then now this one, it's kind of like you get... You know, what did this season do? The first episode was kind of pretty awful. The second episode was really good, had some down parts. The next two-parter was pretty good as a whole with some issues. And then this one was just kind of like, meh, that was an episode. You know, it's like there's no consistency for me. You know, and maybe it's an overall tone. I've been watching a lot of The X-Files lately, and I've been amazed how that show can be dark and scary, can be comedic, can be like this conspiracy-laden thing, a monster or a heartfelt story, and somehow it works. And they have their ups and downs where episodes maybe just don't work, but somehow the overall tone of a season just flows, and it just works. That's what's missing here. You can do your scary or your comedic or your up and down everywhere episodes, but you need to have some kind of consistency, and they're not even having that. It's almost as if they're still doing Capaldi to fit the episode rather than have him be his character and work him into this thing. You know, he's almost not jarring with the episodes enough because he becomes what the episode needs.
Yeah. What? Okay. A couple of comments here, just feeding back on what we're saying. Banana Wa says it's the tone, the writing, and the direction. 2 years as a showrunner seems like a good idea. For me, the soapy nature is extremely irritating. I just want some innovative stories. Flatline, a great example, which I would certainly agree with. And Jeff Waddell, you're bang on. A showrunner should do 3 to 4 years maximum, or it just gets repetitive. In an ideal world, I hope the next showrunner has no connection to who. For the sake of a fresh approach, couldn't agree with any of that, really.
Yeah.
I was just going to say.
Go on, James.
I was just going to say one of the other small things that I'm sort of throwing topic. So if it's still a little on topic, I don't care. I like to be a sort of vague anarchist in this sort of structured system of podcasting. The other thing we should talk about is Clara as well, because I think Clara was particularly poor in this episode too. Mm. And if you're looking about reasons of why the show perhaps doesn't feel consistent, I don't feel she's consistent either. So if your leads aren't feeling consistent, you've not got the anchor for a show which is about radically different settings and genre conventions.
I thought she was better this week than she was last week.
Do you feel that she really relates now to people? I mean, she doesn't seem to... I know they keep sort of trying to address it in the show and they don't manage to do it. That she is now to a point where she's almost... as powered as the Doctor in her ability to control things.
Yeah, she's lost that ability to be an interface, hasn't she?
Yeah, she's just, I don't know.
It was a nice idea that they've done, really. They've done it, like, probably twice. Once in Into the Dalek, and it's kind of in Flatline, and then once earlier this series, and that's about it. They've only done it, like, three times so far.
You know, when Liz Sladen left the role, she said she wanted to leave while she was still popular. She wanted people to still like her character.
Yeah.
And she was absolutely right. She had a great ending. And they even brought her back years later because she was still so popular. Clara had a beautiful ending at the end of season 8. I thought it was brilliant. They both left under false pretenses. And it was such a good moment for season 8. It worked really well. And then she decided she wanted to come back to the show. And this entire season, all I kept hoping is maybe she'll leave in this episode. Maybe she'll leave. Like maybe it was a gimmick. Maybe they just brought her back because they didn't have anybody else. Like, I'm not enjoying her. And it's sad because Jenna Coleman is a really good actress. She really is. But they just don't make good use of Clara. They have not done since she started in this show. So she should have left at the end of season 8 because that was a beautiful ending. It would have been a great way to remember her because it was sad and it was good. Now, I get the sense that, you know, why ever have a female doctor when you've got Clara? Because that's what they're using her for.
Because, I mean, Rose used to do something similar, but there was a slight awareness within the writing, which sort of comes up in, say, Christmas Invasion, where she tries to do the doctor thing and she can't, because no matter how experienced you are at sort of meeting these things, you're unarmed, you're inexperienced, you don't have the ability of someone who exists outside time to take control of things. And they seem to lose that with Clara. So Clara no longer feels like a person. She feels like, as I say, like a Robin to Batman. So you don't interface with her in that sort of way. Her compassion seems to fluctuate between more righteousness, moral righteousness, than actual compassion. And she doesn't even really feel like the person I remember in Time of the Doctor or, you know, earlier still. It just doesn't feel, it feels like a caricature. She's being written, I don't know, and it bugs me that both of them just don't seem, I don't know what I'm going to get from each of them either week, and that sort of creates a bit of a problem for me personally anyway.
If they want a companion that can do more in this kind of sci-fi world, be a bit more of an equal to the Doctor, they probably should look back to Liz Shaw and basically tell kind of a scientific character, but let's say set it in the 50th centuries, you know, with like Jack was, you know, have them be a time agent or something that is also a scientist. This way it's believable these people can do stuff. I mean, when we saw Clara, she was a nanny. And then all of a sudden, one day she became a teacher. Now she's the doctor. I really don't know how a simple human like that is so versatile that they can do anything you throw at them. But, oh, wait, Stephen Moffat writes it. So there you go.
See, this is why I don't understand why they need a contemporary companion, in the sense that whatever companion you get, inevitably they will be of our era. If they come from Traken or eSpace, eventually they boil down to basic archetypes. Yeah. They are the Oliver Twist, Artful Dodger, Adric, or, you know, the young plucky scientist, girl, student almost with Nyssa. But what you have then, you have the ability, if you need to stretch them for the sake of the story, you can have Adric pilot the TARDIS in The Visitation or in the same episode, Nyssa with the destroying the android thing. And you can sort of take them outside the boundaries. But ultimately, people don't really think of them as aliens. They have to be reminded in the script that they don't come from Earth like Tegan, because they are just human tropes. So you don't need them to come from contemporary Earth. And if you need it for writing, especially nowadays, like with the sonic screwdriver, where you need stuff to keep the pacing going along, you don't have the room and you don't have the need to slow down scenes, or because of budgetary reasons, you can use these characters with slightly extra futuristic elements to push a story along and have them confront monsters or help the Doctor create a device or pilot the TARDIS. So, again, I think the show needs to look at these unearthly people just because it might help them in the same way the sonic screwdriver has.
What's that?
I want to write an article on that now. That's
nice.
That's where it should be. Anyway, sorry.
Yeah, but look at like shows that are popular right now. You know, I mean, you've got things like Penny Dreadful, and you've got things like Game of Thrones, you know, TV shows that are set in completely different eras, you know, and people are still finding things, even Ripper Street, as we seem to talk about a lot on here. We can still relate to these people because it's the moral dilemmas, the moral situations yeah. that they're in. You don't need a companion from contemporary Earth. I completely agree. I would love to see a companion from the past. And to be honest, I've said it before, you know, if they really want to harken back to the history of Doctor Who, bring one in from the 60s, because imagine what that would be like in today's world now to tell like a 60s companion, like for instance to see Ian or Barbara or Ben and Polly or something show up in 2015, but to see the actual 2015, what reality is really like here, and not let that year 2000 that Zoe was from on a space station. But I would also like to see a future companion, something different. I'm all for an alien companion, but I understand they want people to relate to these companions. However, how many of us relate to the Doctor? And he's supposed to be the most alien of all, you know?
Yeah.
They really need to step out of this skin
it's
that they're stuck in.
It's patronizing, really.
Well,
there's this natural patronizing that they have, this like ingrained patronizing. If you look at them, children's TV, okay? There's a show called Teacup Travels. This is on CBBS, so this is aimed at like 2 to 6 year olds, something like that. And basically, it's essentially time travel. There's a lady who's there's a brother and a sister who are quite young, 6 or 7, and they have an auntie who gives them a cup of tea, and they essentially go on a trip. Because every time they have a cup of tea out of a particular cup from a particular place, a story comes from it that these kids take part in. And they always set in the past. Now, the idea, and they meet people from the past, and, you know, that these people in the past that they meet become their sort of temporary companions because they have an issue that they're trying to get around. So there's this just ridiculous patronizing attitude about companions from the past, which really, I can't understand why they would have this attitude unless there is some decision being made that there aren't going to be companions from the past and that's the end of it.
No, but I mean, like I say, the whole idea that you won't relate is, well, look at the Vikings.
Yeah, exactly.
They're made in contemporary models, their speech patterns, the jokes. Even Macy, Williams' character, they're all contemporary characters, essentially. So it does seem a rather arbitrary argument that it's got to be from the contemporary culture so people can relate to them, when that's just nonsensical. Yeah. Yeah, that's the problem with Clara at the moment for me.
Okay. Check back. Any comments? Sonic, you just reminded me about the glasses. Can't stand them. I was hoping the breaking of glasses was the end of them, says Banana Noir. And Jeff Waddell there, repeating something that we've said many times, Victorian Clara would have been better as a companion.
Yeah.
Yeah, the sense of wonder that should have had the TARDIS, etc. Yeah.
I think the other slight problem with the episode for me was that I did quite enjoy it. I wasn't sure at first, but by the end of it, I felt satisfied.
I sat there for 45 minutes and I enjoyed it. And I think possibly mellowing's not the right word, but I think without having Kasturbis in the background, maybe my expectations have altered with Doctor Who, because I certainly wasn't spitting at the television or anything like that.
But I thought they did portray the concept a bit. I mean, the whole idea, the basic idea of the show really was you take the Doctor, put him in front of an unstoppable army, and he hasn't got his Sonic, he hasn't got his TARDIS, he can't defeat them, he's got to find a way to defeat them. Then he finds the eels, and then he uses bits of his sonic devices and the phones, which I had mentioned before, and suddenly technology saves the day, even though the sort of ethos of it was he doesn't have his technology, how is he going to save the day? Oh, he uses his technology to save the day, which was a shame, because I thought it was a nice idea to put the TARDIS 2 days away, because the TARDIS has been used so frequently. It was good to get it out of the picture and take it away from him, to make him feel on the own, destroy the sonic whatever, put him on his own. But then they still sort of fell back to it. And I thought, while it was still a fun ending to it, I didn't mind it, I did feel they sort of portrayed what they were doing. They'd obviously created a situation that they didn't really know how to get out of. And so they had to fall back on the standard approaches.
Yeah. No, I agree with that completely. That was one of the things that really bugged me. When they broke the sonic glasses, I thought, okay, we're going to get one of those sonic-free episodes. And then to see that, you know, half of it still worked and Clara was able to teach somebody else how to use it, it was just kind of like, where are we going? What are we doing here? Where are we going with this? When I saw Clara also showing one of the Vikings how to use the phone, you know, I guess you probably could. I guess they could have an understanding of you just press this screen thing. I mean, you can see it. If you do it a couple of times, you can do it. But it still was kind of like, why? Why are we doing this? Why are we going there? And I get it. It worked. The concept was okay. You know, leave Earth or we'll embarrass you. Fine. I don't know. I agree. It would have been nicer to have found something. That's why I wanted them to train the village properly and how to fight these things. To actually teach them something and not just, have one of them faint at the sight of blood. You know, a Viking who faints at the sight of blood. I get it. As a comedic writer, that's kind of funny to you. But you know what? Use it on stage in stand-up. Don't put it in your episode. I do want to ask a question, though, kind of real quick going back to Clara, because I had a thought about this that, just all of a sudden I found interesting. But do you think they skipped a beat when Clara left at the end of season 8 by bringing her back? For series 9, that instead of bringing her back, they should have gone back to someone like that Victorian Clara. Not her, because we know her fate, but we know that Clara's splintered out there. He could have met any one of them, and then we could have instead of having Clara, we could have had this alternate Clara, which would have been great for her as an actress to get into the skin of a similar yet different character, and good for us to see a Clara free of the ties that had binded her for too long with her own character.
I'm therefore compelled in some way to sort of offer a rationale behind that, and that's going to sort of lead me into a huge diatribe about the state of Doctor Who and BBC Wales and what I consider, and I'm not alone in this obviously, to be a show that's not been run in the correct way. There's a massive lack of imagination in, and just stupidity in letting them, you know, departing them, giving them a goodbye script, what appears, you know, two goodbye scripts, if you like, because Christmas, you know, she didn't hop in the TARDIS at the end, did she? And then to then have them back when there's an opportunity to go and do something different. And, you know, James was talking before about Doctor Who becoming, just something that people are used to. I don't think it's the audience that are having that feeling towards Doctor Who. I think it's the Doctor Who producers that have the attitude towards Doctor Who. I think it's too comfortable for the Doctor Who producers. I think they need a huge rethink. They certainly need to at least consider a new showrunner. From what we understand, that's not going to be happening anytime soon. They certainly need to be looking at a complete reformat. Doctor Who went for 7 years and was reformatted. It's now in its 11th year since its return and hasn't had a significant reformat.
Well, some people argue it has. I had this actually on the site that was once called Casterbris. There was someone who replied to me who was saying, well, it has had lots of changes. We've had different companions, we've had different, very different doctors, we've had different split seasons, and we've got double episodes, and that's not really the crux of it, though.
It's not a reformat, is it? That's just
these are just
dealing with things, more or less.
Yeah, it's little tweaks and changes, but it doesn't, I still don't feel it. It feels it's challenging itself. I totally agree, and I think the problem is as much internal as it is external, and I don't think it is just atrophy. When I said that earlier, it's more as devil's advocate. As I've said before, I think in comments, maybe we said last week, I think atrophy is a problem. I think that you will get that after 10 years of any show. The spectacle, you know, the excitement will dwindle because that's how we exist, you know. We couldn't become surgeons, as I've said before, if we are always totally shocked and amazed by the sight of blood. You have to...
Yeah, but my point was, it's not just the audience. I think it's universal. No,
yeah, absolutely. But that's my point, is that this will happen anyway, but what will make the difference is how you combat it. And you combat it through, in my opinion, thick scheduling and a fresh internal retake to make sure the show is actually producing something that is surprising and making people come back and not feel like they've seen it before. So it's an internal thing that's got to be done, and it's a thing, and it's the industry surrounding it has got to give it a nice firm base so the audience know when it's on. I mean,
you also need to make it clever enough for people to want to come back. You know, like we were saying with the doctor and his face, you know, we need to stop having ideas where the audience is like, oh, well, it's obviously this, and it turns out to be that. We've had that since Riversong, Amy Pond was cast. and her name, and it made us just sit there and go, oh, well, she's River Song's mother. You know, it was just like, you know, we and I understand audiences today are much cleverer than they used to be. We get a lot more of the tips and tricks that writers and directors use to make us try to understand a story. But
can I just suggest audiences today are perhaps cleverer than the Doctor Who showrunner?
Yes, I think you can. By all means, you can always interject for that. No, but I mean, it's kind of like the thing that magicians live by. The creed there is that you know, let's expose some of our tricks. Because then once they're out there and they're exposed, it's going to force us to learn more tricks to fool people with our sleight of hand and our magic. And I think writers need to do that same thing. And I think a lot of them do. I mean, you know, clearly there are some shows out there that really keep you guessing and really keep you on your toes. Like Breaking Bad was a really phenomenal show, and it just was solid through and through. They did a damn good job. This show needs to take like a lesson from that and kind of say, okay, well, here's this idea. Is that too easy? Or even if you're going to connect point A and point B, you know, put a whole mess of stuff in between there to throw people off that seem plausible and believable. And even if it is simple, this is why I chose this face. Well, you know, throw us off a lot, make us think otherwise. And then when it gets to the obvious, we're sitting there going, well, damn, it was the obvious the whole time. Yeah. You're just not doing that. We're just not getting that.
I still think there's another problem there as well. And I think this is a problem which happens within the industry and outside the industry, is that there is still far too much attention to fandoms and reacting to fandoms. Because I think the majority of people who watched that episode, when they got to the bit where Capaldi says, I realized while I chose this face, and it showed a couple of shot backs to fires of Pompeii, majority of people watching it, well, maybe might remember the episode, but they might not have connected Capaldi was playing the same character. So you're anchoring a major point in his choices on a very nuanced bit of Easter egg, which is, yeah, it's a long time to kick back to that and expect the casual audiences to get the dramatic catharsis there, because they won't. And you know, it'd probably been better, even though I, you know, personally as a fan, I quite enjoyed seeing that flashback. But for casual people, which is who you are at the moment, looking at as possibly dropping off the watching of the show, that bears nothing to them. I still think they need to be pushing forward. And you can keep these little Easter eggs in, because there were a few Easter eggs in there. The yo-yo the Doctor uses, I'm sure, Brian, you'll know this. Was that a replica of the Tom Baker one? The yellow?
No, that's Capaldi's own yo-yo. I mean, they made it yellow to harken back to it, but it is his own yo-yo, yeah.
Oh, it's his own yo-yo. But I was wondering if that was one, but there's a couple of other lines. Obviously, the neutron flow line, time will always tell. Time will tell, it always does. Yeah. So you've got those little things in there for fans as well, but you can't keep pushing them to the forefront if you don't want to make people who are just casually watching it feel like this is a show for someone else.
So far, this season.
In academic work as well, a lot of people put a lot of emphasis on fans and the plethora of fan responses that you can find. And it will affect industry as well, because industry and media look to fandoms' reactions because it's easy. You know, if you want to see what people are thinking, you go to Twitter. The people who are tweeting about Doctor Who tend to be people who are interested in Doctor Who as fans, not the average person. So you start to reflect the vocal minority rather than the large majority, and I think that balance needs to be addressed still.
Yeah. I think the other thing that really bothered me was you have... The doctor realizes he's got this face for a reason. And at the end of season 8, Danny Pink dies. Clara is devastated. And the doctor realizes, oh, I've got this face for a reason. But he doesn't quite put it together there. And at the end of this story, a person that they met one day in a village, 2 days, 3 days, whatever it was, dies. And the doctor's kind of like, all of a sudden, I know why I have this face. People can't die anymore. I can save that one. And me as an audience member, I'm sitting there going, well, Why can't you save Danny now? Why can't you make your best friend happy? You know, you're bringing this village girl back to life, and you've hardly even known her. Why did Clara not feel this way? You know, it seems to me that Clara probably missed an extremely emotional and dramatic moment there that may have done something for the story. Maybe it would have been rehashing, but to me, if I had lost the love of my life, and my best friend just went ahead and saved some girl that he never knew in a similar way that he could go back and save Danny, you know, for just go back to that car accident and bring him back, you know, like, why? Well, why that made no sense. It was
right. Stop. My argument. You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right, and I think it just goes back to the following through. And I think also the other side of this is, Maisie Williams maybe highlights this, is that in Game of Thrones, like some of the other shows that we've mentioned, you've got a show that is slow burn isn't the right word, storylines that keep you engaged, and they don't tend to overlook the obvious thing like this. Maybe that's because they have their roots in novels. I don't know. But some of the other shows don't. So, we can't just say, Game of Thrones does, the other shows don't. So that can't be the difference. So there is, and maybe it's a lack of mature storytelling. Maybe it's a lack of giving a damn. I don't know. But what I did want to say, and I did try to interject earlier with both of you and failed, so I'm taking over now.
Sorry.
Is this season, so far, we've had Return of Davros, and we've had flashbacks to Genesis of the Daleks. The return of Skaro as Dalek headquarters. We've had an alien knowing who the Doctor was and calling him Time Lord without any prior introduction. We've had quotes from old episodes. We've had the destruction of the sonic device in a historical Earth setting. And we've had the whole Fires of Pompeii thing. So that's at least seven things we've had this series. Has Eric Sowart come back? Going on here? This is like this huge focus. It's like just mining Doctor Who's past. When Doctor Who has never been at its best when it is mining its own past. Doctor Who's always been at its best when it's been heading straight forward, whatever, and just doing new stories, doing new ideas, going in new directions, like it was for quite a bit of last season. Why is it dwelling on this, this whole... It's a little bit, it's inbreeding with itself. I'm very uncomfortable with that aspect of Series 9.
You also, too, this isn't going forward or anything, but you brought it up, so I figure it's worth a mention. But, of course, in the Davros story, you have him talking about that mythical hybrid that the Time Lords had created. And here you have the Doctor creating Maisie and calling her that hybrid. So, like the Game of Thrones thing, it does seem like, okay, we've got that arc thing that's kind of happening. Although it's always so loose in Doctor Who. And in a sense, I think it should be loose in Doctor Who, but it also should be worthwhile, as we've learned in the past of Doctor Who. So if you're going to do
these arcs...
It
shouldn't contradict itself, should it? It shouldn't miss the obvious, like what you've just described before I was speaking.
Right.
But this is what American television does well, is that it has the foresight, usually because it's rooms of writers rather than just singular writers as we do in the UK. But you would input that somewhere quite dramatic a season ago, and then you'd bring it up. But it becomes starts to become a Doctor Who convention where the big thing that happens a series is first mentioned in the first episode. And so it sort of becomes a predicted sort of convention and signals of where you're going to go. I mean, we're talking about it now that, okay, looks like Maisie Williams' character is going to be a big part of this season. It's as if you already know the direction the season's going to go, which you shouldn't, because that shows that you're becoming too rigid. And that also comes down to publicity as well. The Maisie Williams thing gives them publicity, which is good. But then they start spinning stories around her. So this episode, the big clincher at the end, where she becomes important, is slightly lost because you've all been told that she's going to be slightly important. So it was the same with last week, with the Davros is going, sorry, the Doctor's going, someone, the people are going to a dead, it's going to be in a killer belter end to this episode. Well, you've told us that in the publicity. If we didn't even work it out, because it's pretty obvious in the episode, we're certainly now going to know how this episode's going to end.
Which is somewhat ironic when you consider that the big selling point for the first story, having Davros and the Daleks, Davros in particular, was completely overlooked in the promotion.
Hidden, rather than...
completely hidden, yeah.
It's a funny, weird beast. A friend of mine was saying, who deals a lot with... acquisitions, he says that when you look at British promotions to American, it's just very, very backward. They don't have it. It's a very odd way that we promote and how we operate with guest stars and when we renounce them compared to the American model, which seems to be far more logical. But yeah, it's a funny thing. The thing with Clara, you were saying, the only thing I'd add to that is that I don't think you could have quite quite easily assume that this Clara is a different Clara, because aside from about one mention, reference to Danny with Missy, there's no real connections to the past at all with her. She's just almost like a brand new character. So for all you could say is that she is someone else he's picked up who had a boyfriend called Danny. I've got a few comments here, I think.
Real quick, before those, I just want to say, do you think the promotion, do you think they changed their plan of promotion after not promoting the Dalek story, as you said, with all the facts and seeing how the ratings just dropped? Do you think then they were like, well, shoot, let's give them everything and make them want to come in? Or do
I think that a lot of it happened. I think a lot of it was available before the Dalek story came along. Okay. So, yeah.
All right, comments, sorry.
Comments. Does someone else want to have a look at those this time?
Well, see, Brad, who's actually an old friend of mine from, like, I don't know, Yahoo Groups days when we used to talk about Blake 7. He's actually entered into the fray, the fan wankery of old series references. It's a shame, isn't it, when fans do start to feel like that, when you're sort of getting too much of a glut, it becomes less special, and it feels too much. I think there is a truth there. So Banana Wire again agrees with you, Tristan Farnham. The show should move forward.
I was actually thinking of taking a trip out to Asquith in the next week or so, which is where they shot the externals in Old Creatures.
Old Creatures, yes, I've been there.
Have you?
I went there. The pub there does a very good fish and chip, surprisingly, for being landlocked. But
right. Well, there's a nice pub in Thirst that does fish and chips as well.
Yeah, but Asprey was a commissioning as well, which I never quite understood. But anyway, sorry, what were you saying?
No, do carry on. We're getting sidetracked here.
We certainly are. We're certainly getting sidetracked.
Okay, so, well, listen, we're going to leave. Shall we? We have previously thrown some numbers around for our feelings towards these episodes so far. So, does anyone want to throw a number at the girl who died?
I'm going to have to go with sort of 7.5 again, because like last week, very different episode, but
yeah,
there was some stuff I came out of it feeling I enjoyed it, even though I went into it feeling I wouldn't, and that was the same with last week.
Yeah, I think
there was definitely issues there.
Yeah, I'm in general agreement. I didn't have any. I was kind of given the impression from some previews I wouldn't enjoy it, but I didn't read the previews. Yeah. They were just from like, the headlines from the previews. So I didn't read the previews. I didn't even read Philip Bates' preview. So sorry, Phil, who's been doing previews and reviews for the Lavazzi website, where you can get excellent Doctor Who scarves. There's no affiliate link. You can just go to lavazzi.co.uk and get Doctor Who scarves and T-shirts and jumpers and umbrellas and things like that. They're lovely. And I would say 7 again as well. Brian?
I'm probably just going to go with the 5. Because I kept feeling like this story had potential and it could just rise up, but instead it just kept staying on that flat line of the mediocre where we've been stuck. And it seemed like it was really good because it had all that great beginning, taking the Doctor out of his element and putting him in that technology-less kind of situation, and then it just went back with the comedy, the humor, bringing the technology back in, as James had pointed out. And I just felt like, man, it really could have escalated. It really could have been good. It was on that kind of 5, like, that was a good episode, okay, but not great, and it wasn't a stinker either. So I'm just going to put it middle ground.
Okay, that's fair enough. Now, before we depart, and we've got a couple of little things to talk about. First of all, you probably know about this already, but John Hurt says he's clear of pancreatic cancer, which is fantastic news. So congratulations, John, and all the best wishes from us. They've obviously got some John Hurt Big Finish coming up. I suspect they probably recorded a lot of it together because he is an actor who is in demand, despite the fact that he is retired. officially, he just seems to keep on working. It's nice when you can just keep on working despite being retired, isn't it? I imagine. I don't know. Not been retired. Mark Gatiss has been talking about a male companion for the Doctor, not for himself. And he says that the idea is very interesting. I've always been a fan of the boy-girl partnership from way back when, he told press at the Attitude Awards on October 14th, so midweek on Wednesday night. I think the dynamic then would be really interesting. It would be great. Doctor Who is always driven on change. All you need is a fantastic actor for the part. But I hope Capaldi stays for a very long time before, because he's great. You know, many of the criticisms, you know, from people who don't like Capaldi are going to say, well, Capaldi's not very good. Maybe Capaldi's the reason that Doctor Who isn't performing so well. Gator says that Capaldi's grown into it, which is always what happens. I love the way people have responded to this series, and I love the two-parters as well. I'm not entirely sure how people are responding to this series, but I do think that that Capaldi's getting a bit of stick that he shouldn't, that he doesn't deserve.
I still think that Capaldi, I still think there is a reluctance on, I think there is ageism within in the casual audience. I think because the show has had 10 years of youngish faces, a lot of those people aren't classic fans. They will not associate the Doctor as an older character, even though he's not that old. And he certainly plays him with a vitality that doesn't suggest age. I think there's a lot of shallowness in television watching, which is, or in everything. People have busy lives. They don't really think about things as much as possibly we do. I think there is a factor there. I don't think it means they shouldn't do stuff like this. I don't think it means that he's bad in any way whatsoever. But I do probably think, unfortunately, they'd have to acknowledge that breaking the brand almost of this youngish, heroic, almost Bond-like character and going for an older man, for a lot of people, newer people, it might have been a bit of a jarring thing. And if the stories aren't connecting, the schedule is whacked, out of place, they go and do other things, it could be a contributing factor, but I wouldn't think it's the main one at all. But I think there is a problem there that I don't know how you address, because it shouldn't be a problem.
Well, I think you address it with two companions, don't you?
I think
that's how it's been done in the past.
Yeah, and I'm surprised they didn't do that. Yeah. I don't know why they didn't do it. They didn't really do it with Danny either, which was a shame.
Things would have been so much different if they just took him on the TARDIS,
But I think my only concern at the moment is with, you know, no sign of Moffat leaving Doctor Who. And as I've said before, you know, he does, he's always, there's no, you can't deny there's a lot of stuff he has brought to Doctor Who over the years. You can't sort of dismiss the stuff which may be feeling lukewarm now to the stuff he's done before. But, you know, you saw Russell T Davies when he struggled with various franchises running at the same time, Torchwood, Sarah Jane Smith, Doctor Who. And coming up now, we've got Class being produced by him as an exec. You've got Sherlock still running. You've got Doctor Who running. And you're kind of worrying, you know, has having two been a problem for him giving commitment or his total focus as a professional? Is three going to make it harder? It was certainly for Russell T Davies, according to his book.
Yeah.
He couldn't cope with Torchwood by the end of it because he was so focused and drained with Doctor Who.
Yeah.
So I'm kind of hoping that, you know, this isn't, problems are going to get better rather than get worse, however they're done, however they're resolved.
Okay. Well, that does, I'm delighted we've had so many with us for the full 70 minutes or so, and so many comments in as well. Thank you, everyone who's taken part. Banana, Jeff, Colin, Jeff again, Banana, and Brad. Banana finishes, don't necessarily agree with James Ray Capaldi. More of the issue has been the poor writing for him and not playing to his strengths. They bottled it from the start, apologising for him not being young.
It's true, though. Do you think that with the way he looks as well, they seem to put him in youthful clothing, they throw the guitar in there. These are all things which are part of the actor as well. But do you feel that it's almost a bit like an apologist sort of thing? That, I don't know. As I say, I don't have an issue with Capaldi at all. I like him. I think
it's clear that Capaldi engages well with younger fans. You know, that, you know, the clip from the Doctor Experience last year, or earlier this year, sorry, when he was talking to all those fans in character. When he, you know, just turned up for the day, so I think if there is, I do feel that there was some apologism from BBC Wales with the casting when they, you know, maybe a few noisy people on Twitter or Gallifrey Base or Tumblr or wherever people whinge the most these days, decided that, you know, he's too old, but too old. Because clearly he's not too old. He's clearly doing an excellent job.
But if you've got audiences who go for the main character because they find him sort of sexy, you might find that there's a certain type of people who are sort of engaged in that way. I mean, you imagine if male fans, they put in, which they should do, an older female companion, you know, say in their 50s. I wonder, you know, if some of the men would go, oh, I'm not so interested because I haven't got the legs anymore. You know, you do have that sort of person watching the show.
Do you mean like River Song?
Well, I think she'd take... I think she'd take umbrage with you over the 50s comment there, to be honest.
Oh, and I think so. Ah, so.
Appreciate that.
Well, she's a fictional character, so I don't think we need to worry too much about that. Okay, so thank you again for everyone who's taken part on this this week's podcast with the Cave. This is brilliant, because I'm not just thanking Brian and James, because really, although I'm, you know, doing the voice and the intro and the outro thing, this is like, this is... properly a three-man podcast now. There's no, like, site in the background to, you know, that I'm sort of in charge, and so I have this sort of, like, vague authority. You know, this guy here is looking a bit bewildered at the moment, and this guy here, who you probably can't see, who looks like Morph, this is like a trio. This is like the Police or some other popular beat combo with three people in. And so, you know, we're all equal on the podcast with the K. You guys are our guests, so thank you to everyone on Hangouts, and thank you, dear listener, for sticking with us. You've lost a bit of weight, we've noticed. You've slimmed down slightly, but you're still there and downloading, and we're thrilled with how things have gone over the last few weeks. So thank you very much. We will be back next time discussing the Woman Who Lived. So it's goodbye from me. And does anyone else want to say goodbye?
Oh, we're doing nothing again?
No, just say goodbye. We're not doing this goodbye for me and this goodbye for me and this goodbye for me. We're not doing that, Brian.
Right. Really going back to the old days there. Seriously, thanks to all the listeners that are here. Thanks for all the comments that everybody posted today. Thanks to both of you guys, because I live for these moments. I really enjoy our podcast. So, yeah, thanks very much, and we'll see you next time.
Yep. Goodbye, everybody.